direct from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
An eye-opening employment number. I'm Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti. Glad you're with us. First full weekend in May. Welcome aboard. Here's what's coming up during this program.
The Labor Department says 288,000 jobs were created last month, a number that surpassed most expectations.
The changing future of cars. We'll examine the importance of the new BMW i8.
With wedding season upon us, how ready are you to dance? We'll have some tips on how to survive when you're dragged onto the dance floor.
And baseball games are taking longer than ever. Is there anything that can be done to pick up the pace?
Part of the problem that prevents them from really feeling the urgency to make dramatic changes are things are pretty good right now. You know, that 55 and older demographic, it may not be around forever, but it's got some good years left in it, and it's doing pretty well for the game right now.
Wall Street Journal reporter Brian Costa on potential tweaks to speed up baseball. And good luck with that. Maryland, as you may know, is building a new health exchange. In doing so, it must ensure that new software code and applications work with the state's current Medicaid system. What went wrong the first time around? Maryland Congressman Andy Harris joins us from the T-Mobile hotline to discuss it further. Congressman, this is a big change of plans.
Yes, after spending well over $100 million in federal funds, the health department in Maryland has decided that it's going to abandon the Maryland Health Exchange and, buy the product from Connecticut and see if that'll work any better this coming year.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think there was an audit that said state officials in Maryland and Oracle were responsible for these problems, correct?
The first audit done was done by state auditors with very limited access to information. They really only had access to information that was available to the public, and their conclusion was that the oversight was lacking of the contractors. So they didn't blame the contractors, they blamed the lack of oversight. But of course, more thorough investigation is necessary and is ongoing now by the HHS Inspector General's office.
All right, so from what you're hearing from constituents, the impact has been what?
Well, obviously, there is a lot of frustration. Anyone who tried to use the exchange was frustrated from day one, and there are many people who still don't have their premium payment down correctly. There's concern that, again, it may not even work in November, since they're going to put a whole new system in place, the Connecticut system, but there's a limited number of months to get that working.
We're speaking with Congressman Andy Harris of Maryland about the Maryland Health Exchange. So, more broadly here, with the federal exchange, how is your office handling this or implementing it, say, with your own staff?
Well, our staff have the choice to go to the exchange, the DC exchange, the shop exchange, and most of the staff took that option. Some didn't. I didn't take the option. The plans are way overpriced on the exchanges, just like they are on the individual exchanges. But again, we tried to make that work.
And what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act now? How do you see it? Are you in the corner of repeal this thing or fix it?
97% of it has to be repealed. I think you should retain the ability of children up to age 26 to be covered under their parents' plan, even if it's for an additional premium. We should retain the ability to promote the high-risk pools in states, and we really have to, I think, eliminate the lifetime or annual caps on coverage. But beyond that, the other 97% of the of Obamacare should be repealed. We're about to go into the second round of premiums, and I think people will be shocked at the premium increases on the Obamacare exchanges that are going to be announced this year.
What's the reality or the likely scenario in terms of potential changes or, a 97% repeal, as you said?
I think that'll have to wait until after we get a new president. Obviously, President Obama is not going to sign any kind of major repeal efforts. And so this is just going to limp along, causing harm and grief for millions of Americans, increased costs of insurance, millions of people losing their insurance, employers stopping coverage. And it's just going to have to limp along until 2017. Again, this is going to be an interesting summer as we look at to see the premium increases. And then, of course, more delays, which I believe the administration is going to implement because the small business and large business mandates are just not workable.
Thanks, Congressman. Maryland Congressman Andy Harris. 11 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. Coming up next, what happens when you care too much about work?
Hi, I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business called Podlexing, so I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. With so many job boards out there, how can you know which one will produce the best talent? Realistically, to fill the position fast and with the perfect candidate, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can do it with a single click with ZipRecruiter.com. ZipRecruiter.com lets you post to more than 40 job sites at once. ZipRecruiter.com also posts your job on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Just post once and watch the qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. You can screen applicants, rate them, and hire the right people fast. Try ZipRecruiter free right now and find out why it's been used by over 100,000 businesses. And right now, listeners of this program can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. That's ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. One more time, to try ZipRecruiter for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ.
Thanks for being with us. You know, some people are happy just doing their job and not worrying about their company's larger organization. Other people love thinking about their workplace's big picture situation. Are the most innovative ideas being implemented? Are talented people being encouraged and retained? The problem is most people are not in a position to change the larger organization. Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenberger is here to explain how to cope if you care too much about work. Sue, what'd you find in exploring this?
There is a small but significant minority of workers who are really loyalists or idealists. They are organization lovers. They identify with their companies, and they actually care when the company does something stupid or promotes the wrong person. They're emotionally involved, even if it doesn't affect them personally.
All right. So these folks, though, do they feel they can be the big change if they feel change is needed?
That's the frustration, and that's what we focus on in the story. People who feel this way, what can you do about it? Some of these loyalists I interviewed found that they actually had to leave or quit their companies if the violations of what they thought were shared values and ethics and purpose were too great. For example, one woman worked for an oil company, and she believed deeply in environmental and human rights issues, and she worked in that area for the company. But when she saw management going the other way, she left the company, just could not work there. Sometimes you just have to leave. Other times you can try to bring about change internally.
All right. So if you're motivated to do this internally, what are some of the steps?
First of all, you have to stop and make sure you're not overreacting. Organization lovers, these loyalists or idealists, can sometimes get quite emotional, and you have to stop and separate out the emotion, look at it logically, give it a few days to cool off, and figure out what you might influence and what you might not be able to influence, just to stay sane. Sometimes it's as easy as asking neutral questions to raise issues for discussion. I mean, that's one technique that can work well.
Do these folks feel, too, I guess a little bit along those lines, that sometimes ideas go to waste?
It's easy to feel that way if you set out a good idea and it's not acted on. And sometimes the way that you bring it up is what matters. Other times that's just the breaks of the game, and you feel better just having said something. One thing that you can do is to, you know, wait for a general staff meeting or a meeting with your manager and just say, you know, I wanted to ask you about the process for choosing people for promotion. This is something that I've been asked about a lot by my own team, and I'm wondering, how do we do that? Another thing you can do is volunteer to join an internal task force that looks at business processes. Continuous improvement. Improvement is the jargon these days, and sometimes getting involved in one of those quality improvement groups can give you a chance to set your ideas forth. Other times, just speak up. Tell your boss in a private meeting, or maybe ask permission to speak to a manager in another unit and offer your ideas to be helpful. You might get turned down, but again, you might have a chance to speak up and perhaps be heard.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenberger. All right, so for these folks who worry about the larger organization here, the company, can you make changes more likely if you're with a big firm or a small firm, or does it kind of depend?
It certainly is easier most times at a small firm, although what really matters the most is the attitude of management. I spoke to one top executive at HubSpot, an online marketing software company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Dharmesh Shah. He really invites employees to speak up, voice dissent and disagreement. He sees that as a sign of loyalty. He really likes having people who are willing willing to air their disagreements, and he believes it helps him manage the company better. In other cases, a nurse I interviewed who worked for a very large hospital was really disturbed by some of the care techniques she saw being used in the neonatal intensive care unit. She was able, even in a very large organization, to patiently, slowly explain her ideas, document them with research, show how things might be improved, gather allies, work on an internal task force for quality improvement, and eventually get most of her ideas put into effect. It can happen in either size organization. Much depends on either the attitude of top management or whether management has put in place ways for employees to get involved in decision making.
Seems more young people are interested in trying to affect some of these changes. And with the use of social media, I wonder if it's not easier today to try to make a big change to an organization than, say, years ago when we always reference the good old boys network at the top of some of these companies.
That's really true. At HubSpot, the company I mentioned earlier in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the management deliberately uses a wiki for executives to post their ideas and thoughts and get reaction. And sometimes it gets some pretty strong negative responses. It is true that among other employee groups that millennials tend to be sort of engaged in their jobs and passionate about their work at higher rates than older employee groups and really looking for perhaps their ideals to be realized in the workplace.
Thanks, Sue. Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger, who's based in Portland, Oregon. It's 20 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. It's time for Gina Cervetti.
The April jobs report came in quite a bit stronger than what most economists were expecting. It shows that 288,000 jobs were created and the unemployment rate declining from 6.7 to 6.3%. But Gus Fauché with PNC suggests that number is a little bit misleading.
We saw a decline in the labor force of more than 800,000. We saw a decline in the labor force participation rate. According to the household survey, the number of employed actually declined slightly. So the decline in the unemployment rate was kind of for the wrong reasons. And I would expect that the unemployment rate will move higher over the next month or two as we see more people coming back into the labor force.
Career Builder says that when it comes to construction employment, certain sectors are doing better than others. Commercial and industrial building is outpacing residential construction. And from 2011 to the end of this year, the increase in commercial building jobs is expected to be 4%, while jobs in residential construction are expected to grow by about 3%. An important report leads off the economic calendar for the coming week. Economist Joel Naroff is anxious to see the latest on the non-manufacturing part of our economy, which makes up most of economic activity.
We need to see how the services sector is doing. And I suspect that with winter being over, spring starting to come out, people are back out spending.
A new General Motors recall covers almost 54,000 Cadillac SRX crossovers. The Detroit News said that a software problem in the 2013 model could delay acceleration. There have been no reports of accidents or injuries as of the weekend. April auto sales were mostly higher, and despite previous recalls, GM sales were up almost 7% from a year ago.
The vehicles involved in the recall are no longer for sale. Some are from brands that no longer even exist, like Pontiac and Saturn. So I don't think that people necessarily correlate what's happening with the GM recall with the new GM.
Jessica Caldwell at Edmunds. Meanwhile, Chrysler, Fiat, and Nissan sales were standouts, up 14 and 18% respectively. And Ford sales slipped almost 1%, but Ford truck sales were strong. Microsoft is out with a fix for that security problem in its Internet Explorer web browser, including a patch for its XP operating system, which it had recently stopped supporting. And a new Consumer Reports survey finds that about one-fifth of us uses our smartphone as a sort of remote control device. But the publication cautions that before you invest in appliances and other so-called smart products, consider potential pitfalls such as security and also privacy concerns, as our information may be tracked these days.
Mm-hmm.
Things like thermostats,
yes.
Now, and just thinking, the only
lights.
Thing that I lights, the Google Chromecast, which I like.
Yeah.
You can use your smartphone as a sort of remote control for the television set.
Yes.
With that.
Our tech analyst, Rob Enderle, once estimated that I was approximately 4 to 5 years before the technology curve, which places me at like the class of 2018, for using my phone, for example, as a remote control.
Well,
so
we'll make sure to check in with you at that point and see how things are going, Gordon.
Still some years away. Thank you, Gina. 23 minutes after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Coming up next, a peek at the future of cars. Hey, good on you for being here. With its i8, BMW goes on a radical weight loss program to make modern cars fast and efficient. Wall Street Journal automotive writer Dan Neal looks at how this approach will change all the cars we'll drive in the near future. Dan, explain the trend.
It's fair to say that manufacturers have pretty much come to the end of their development of the steel-bodied chassis.
Yeah.
Problem is that regulations require them to lose, you know, hundreds and maybe, you know, more than 1,000 pounds of vehicle weight to meet strict standards coming in the next decade. So BMW decided to build cars a radically different way. And that's this way I described in the story, where they have this aluminum skateboard, which has all the powertrain built into it and sort of encapsulated in this frame. And then the carbon fiber body is laid back on top. And in many respects, it's going back to body-on-frame construction. The i8 is a $125,000 Grand Touring 2+2 sports car, and it has three cylinders. It uses a 1.5-liter gas turbo engine combined with a very powerful and very smart hybrid electric powertrain. And so it delivers essentially sports car performance with half the emissions and twice the range. And if you drive it right, according to the EU, the thing will get 135 miles per gallon.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal automotive writer Dan Neal about changing the future of cars. All right, so you mentioned this BMW i8 at $125,000. That's not in my future of cars. When does it come out?
It's true that I or you might not buy, you know, a 2+2, $100,000 sports car. But what's important about this program for BMW is that there's really no way back. I mean, they have concluded that this is the better way to build automobiles. And indeed, it would seem so, since this car weighs 3,276 pounds, which is approximately 1,200 pounds lighter than a conventional steel-bodied car with similar performance. That is a ton. I mean, it's a half a ton of weight, but it's just an staggering figure, weight savings. And so, you know, if you're BMW and you see you can do this, it's very hard to go back and building cars in a suboptimum way. And so this represents a huge bet for BMW in terms of weight saving technology. And the point is of that is that this technology will be generalized very soon. I think you will be driving a version of this in the next 20 years, whether from BMW or another manufacturer.
What if it doesn't work out? That is a huge investment that they've made.
It is. And, you know, this is a little bit of a head scratcher. Now, a couple of contextual points. BMW is the most profitable luxury car maker in the world. They're at the top of their game, not by volume, the biggest car maker, but they are doing quite well. And they're very forward-thinking. Plus, you know, European car makers are under intense social, political, and regulatory pressure on carbon emissions. And so BMW has decided to take this step forward, and it's a big step. And you're right, it's fraught with peril. We don't know how it's going to work out. But the numbers don't lie. The technology works great.
Thanks, Dan. Wall Street Journal automotive writer Dan Neal. The BMW i8 is really cool looking. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Coming up next, will Marvel's movie superheroes ever get along at the box office? Squarespace, the easiest way to create an exceptional website. Squarespace provides everything you need to create a beautiful website for you or your business, including trendy designs and unique styles. And you don't have to worry about getting stuck along the way. Squarespace has a 24/7 support team. Try Squarespace today for free. And when you're ready to go live, enter WSJ at checkout and save 10%. Plus, you get free hosting. Use promo code WSJ at squarespace.com/WSJ. Squarespace.com/WSJ.
We help farmers make the best use of their land, which means healthier crops, higher yields, and less harvesting hours, which is good news for a growing population and good news for the environment. BASF, the chemical company.
First full weekend in May. Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti coming up this half hour. The technology that summer camps are using to attract families, plus what baseball can do to speed up games that are taking longer than ever. We'll have that report in about 15 minutes. As you know, Marvel superheroes are priceless movie properties. They've been among the top five movies at the box office for seven of the past 10 years. This year, we'll see a record four Marvel-based movies. Why can't they all be friends, though, at the box office? Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Fritz says complex business deals that go back decades means the cinematic characters are split among different studios. Ben, what's this about?
There are four different Marvel superhero movies coming out this year, all based on Marvel comic books, but they're from three different studios. So Fox controls the X-Men, when you have X-Men Days of Future Past on Memorial Day. Sony controls Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And Marvel Studios, which is owned by Disney, they put out Captain America 2 earlier this month. They have Guardians of the Galaxy in August. And so even though these characters all live together, meet each other, sometimes fight with each other in the comic book, in the movies, they are controlled by different companies, and they can never meet, they can never cross over. I think much to the confusion and frustration of some fans.
Does this trend of different studios owning these movies show any signs of letting up?
Not at all. It's only accelerating because, honestly, the movies keep doing really well. Captain America, The Winter Soldier is the number one movie of the year so far for the past decade. Seven of the past 10 years, a Marvel movie has been in the top five, and then that doesn't even include Batman movies made by Warner Brothers from their DC Comics universe. We're just going to see more and more. For the foreseeable future, there's going to be four or five Marvel movies every year coming between Disney, Fox, and Sony.
Does not having these characters interact with one another pose some challenges?
Yeah, I think, that's the kind of thing fans would love to see and would make for a major event movie that would probably be, as big as Avengers or bigger. But it's very complicated for these companies to work together on something like that, so it's unlikely to happen.
Why is it so complicated?
First, companies have to agree on how they're going to share the money and the cost, and the revenue, which, given that they all control what they probably think is the most important character, would be difficult. Then there's a question of who's going to make the movie and how. You have to explain why the characters have never met before. You have to balance sort of the different tone of the Spider-Man movies versus X-Men versus Avengers. You have to feature all these characters together in just a two-hour movie. It's extremely complicated. It would take a lot of agreement, a lot of coordination, and people in Hollywood are not known for playing nice together.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Fritz. Is it also hard on the writers who can't use the comic books for reference, since the characters can't interact?
Exactly, right. So they in the comic books, Spider-Man, Avengers, Fantastic Four, they all live together in New York City. But in the movies, there's different versions of New York City where they might only have one superhero or a few superheroes. So it's a very weird thing.
You mentioned these movies have been very successful. Why have they been so successful?
So Marvel Studios, owned by Disney, has been doing two movies per year, and they've been very successful. And part of the reason, I think, is each movie sort of leads into another. So even though Captain America is not, per se, a sequel to Thor, there's some story elements that carry over from one to another. So to fans, it sort of feels like a sequel, and so you feel like you're just watching the next chapter of the same story, and that's tended to work very well. So there hasn't been a single flop from Disney-owned Marvel Studios. I think that's a big reason. I think Sony and Fox have seen that, and they're trying to follow the same pattern with their X-Men and Spider-Man movies.
What kind of budgets are we talking about here, Ben, and what kind of return on investments are these studios seeing?
These are very big budget movies. You have massive special effects, so they're not cheap. The Amazing Spider-Man 2 cost a little over $250 million, which is about as expensive as movies get unless James Cameron's making them. You really couldn't do one for, I think, less than $150, the absolute minimum. And on the other hand, these movies can be hugely successful. They're very popular, not just in the U.S., but around the world. People love superheroes. They love these big event movies. There have been several that have grossed more than $1 billion at the box office, and that's the kind of number that all the studios are going for and dreaming of right now.
Thanks, Ben. Wall Street Journal reporter Ben Fritz. It is 22 minutes before the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Coming up next, surviving the dance floor when you hate to dance but feel obligated to. Welcome aboard. So why are some people comfortable on the dance floor while the rest of us dread that moment at, say, a wedding? Why, that is me and my wife right there. Here's what you can do if you dread getting dragged onto the dance floor. A couple of basic moves to avoid getting laughed at. They're from Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Holmes. Elizabeth, set this up.
'Tis the season of dancing, and for some people it's, a really fun thing. The music starts playing at a wedding or a bar mitzvah and they jump out of their seats. But for a lot of other people, it's a big anxiety-inducing moment. They don't necessarily enjoy dancing. They don't think they're good at it. They can't maybe find the beat. They don't know what to do with their arms or their feet. And so it can be a not fun thing for a lot of people. And so we took a look at, how to learn to dance and how to sort of feel comfortable in those social settings.
So you mentioned something, though, because I understand rhythm. And I can move my feet to the beat, but you said it, I'm not always quite sure what to do with my arms.
So everybody has a different skill, right? You know what I mean? So I took a lot of piano lessons as a kid, so I can find a beat, but I'm not necessarily super coordinated.
Okay.
And so I have a hard time when I'm out there doing, you know, crazy dance moves that require like moving your arms in one direction and your feet in another direction. So the first thing is to try and find the beat, which is really important, and then just get moving. And so as long as you're moving, that can be sort of, you know, an abstract version of dancing. One professor at NYU I talked to said, you know, if you don't feel comfortable on the dance floor, just get up and start walking in patterns on the floor, like a
what?
Zigzag
or
figure
eight,
just so you get moving, because some people are so scared of dancing, Gordon, that they just sit there and sort of freeze up. So get moving.
Okay.
And then, you know, the basic foot movement can be super simple. It can be just a step touch where you literally step to one side and bring your foot to meet it and then do it again and again and
that's
again.
Mine.
And again.
Yeah, that's mine.
That's
my
a great
patented
one.
Move. Yes.
As long as you're on the beat, that's fine. You can clap and snap and, you know, move your arms. But I will say, pay a lot of attention to your upper body. There was this fascinating study out of the UK where they looked at the attractiveness of dance moves in men and had sort of female rate them based on their attractiveness and the moves, and they found that the legs and the feet actually don't matter very much. It's all about the upper body, the chest and the neck and the head and the arms.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Holmes. That's interesting because in our family scenario, my wife, she dances with everything. Like there's not music she won't dance to. So if we're at a function, she's up. And I'm sort of waiting for the song where I can legitimately, like, do my, you know, sidestep thing that you mentioned before.
That's a big part of it, is that
yeah.
you wait for the music, right? Because
yeah.
the musician should do some of the heavy lifting here. The best musicians kind of build an arc of music over the course of the evening. They don't come out with their biggest song first. You know, they start with older music from the 60s and 70s that perhaps all generations at the party will know. And mm-hmm. then they sort of build to more popular and contemporary things. But I will say there are some songs that are much easier to dance to.
Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Holmes. By the way, you have to check out the video. It's very clever. She takes these lessons with an instructor in New York. Very good. Some of the basics. That's sidestep move. That's my patented move. Never hurt myself yet. 16 minutes in front of the hour now on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Being with us, it may not seem possible, but baseball games are getting even longer and less exciting. A spike in strikeouts has caused at-bats to drag on, and the inability to put the ball in play has meant less action. Wall Street Journal reporter Brian Costa is examining what, if anything, can be done. Brian, does instant replay get some blame this season, too?
That is one factor, but when you look at how often replay is actually being used and how long it takes, that doesn't account for all of it. There's still the same issues with just players not moving all that quickly.
All right, so what's out there? Anything officially on the table?
Well, MLB for a while now has had people monitoring pace of play closely. They do occasionally send warning letters and then at times fines for players who are really dawdling around too much. But the sort of broader changes that would result in a dramatic quickening of play, they really haven't wanted to do yet. The Atlantic League, which is an independent minor league, tried some things last year that were very interesting. Some of it was just enforcing rules that already existed, some of which was instituting new guidelines. And it sort of worked for a while, but even then, league officials say that when given the opportunity, players and managers sort of slipped back into their old habits as the season went along. So even at the minor league level, they're looking at this now and saying, what else can we try? What more drastic measures do we need to take to change this?
All right. Does that mean that there have been complaints made to the head office, or is this something the league has noticed on its own because they also were falling asleep watching games?
Well, the Atlantic League says that they have heard directly in fan surveys that the pace of game is a turn off to them. That's something they want to see improved on. I think for MLB, it's sort of common sense. You look at the youth viewership numbers, the youth participation numbers in baseball and the way those are trending, and it's pretty logical that to see baseball getting slower at a time when society has less patience is probably not the best thing for its long-term interest.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports reporter Brian Costa about can anything speed up a baseball game. So don't look for anything. Is that what you're saying? There, things might be discussed, but nothing really is going to happen?
Well, we'll see. I mean, the Boston Red Sox are undertaking a major study right now of their own games at the request of Commissioner Seely to try to see, really quantify all the little things that drag the place of play and suggest changes. And it remains to be seen what they'll suggest and, more to the point, what MLB will actually do about it. But it's not an issue they're ignoring, that's for sure.
How about the TV networks? Do they have a say in this?
Well, TV is king in baseball, and it's really what's fueling the rise in revenue and franchise values. However, things still really haven't gotten bad enough, you know, in terms of ratings or the like, where there would be dramatic pressure on baseball to speed things up.
Thanks, Brian. Wall Street Journal reporter Brian Costa. How about seven-inning games? Three balls instead of four, two strikes instead of three. 9 minutes now in front of the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Once again, here's Gina Cervetti.
This coming week brings more economic reports after we had that April employment data that came out on Friday. This coming week, we get an update on the trade gap, among other things. Economist Joel Naroff says he does expect a bigger gap for the month of March.
Maybe not the $3 billion increase that we saw in February, but I wouldn't be surprised if we tacked on another $1 billion to that deficit.
Next week also brings updates on worker productivity and consumer credit. Are you putting enough money away for retirement? Chris Augelli with ADP Retirement Services says many younger workers especially do not seem focused on saving for their later years.
Less than half of employees who are between the ages of 20 and 29 are actively saving for retirement in a workplace savings program. And those who do, they're putting aside less than 5% of their salary.
Meanwhile, ADP also finds that more women are saving for retirement than are men. And in companies with fewer than 20 employees, the savings rate was better than at larger companies. Small businesses do have big concerns. Allstate Business Insurance did a survey recently and found that there are several things troubling owners and operators of the nation's smaller businesses. Allstate's Mike Barton says government issues and health care are at the top of the list.
So they want to grow, they want to make money, and they've got to do so in a highly complex regulatory environment. The real challenge for them is they just don't have the resources available to them that the same big companies have across America.
Other concerns include getting financing, building and keeping customers for their small businesses, and recruiting and retaining skilled staff. Well, when it comes to bold flavors, food manufacturers are making some bold moves. The Journal's Sarah Nassauer says companies are coming up with several new flavors to boost their sales.
Indian spices, Thai food, that type of chili, lime, cilantro kind of mix flavor is getting a lot of attention. It's beyond just Hispanic spiced flavors. It's really all over the world.
New products are aimed at a younger, diverse group of consumers.
I'm willing to try almost anything spice-related.
Okay.
And I like to sweat.
You do?
When I try something.
See, I'm the other way. I don't like that so much.
But it's got to be at home. I don't want to do it at a restaurant. You don't want to be dripping over the food.
You don't want to have to, blot your brow while you're sitting at the table. Is that it?
Got to be, precisely calculated as to when it happens.
The chili lime sounds good.
I agree. Thank you, Gina. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Coming up next, how summer camps are trying to attract families.
My daughter is a handful. I've always had to keep my eye on her, but I didn't always watch out for myself. With so much noise about healthcare, I tuned it all out. With United Healthcare, I get information that matters. My individual health profile, not random statistics. They even reward me for addressing my health risks. So I'm doing fine, but she's still going to give me a heart attack.
Innovations that work for you. That's health in numbers. United Healthcare.
Summer camps are using all the high-tech tricks to attract families. One company called Bunk Connect uses the model adopted by discount travel websites.
Try and find out where these empty beds are at 150 camps in the Northeast and then offer them to parents at a discount. So rather than those weeks going with the beds unfilled, they can offer them at a discount.
Wall Street Journal reporter Heidi Mitchell says one camp in California uses the virtual conferencing service GoToMeeting to help sell camps.
They can do orientation online rather than having parents come out, especially for international kids. It can be difficult, but they can make them feel like they're ready to join this community without having to meet everybody in advance in person.
Once away, companies are helping connect parents with kids since camps promise the kids will be unplugged.
they basically put everything, you know, the notes you used to send to your kids and the care packages you used to send to your kids, they do that all through a portal for parents. So they can write a letter online, an email, and then they'll print it out and give it to the kid.
Changes are working, by the way. Last year, 74% of camps reported their highest enrollment since 2008. For Gina Cervetti, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to the Wall Street Journal This Weekend.